This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/iFanboy.
You're listening to iFanboy Talksplode with Jason Aaron, writer of Star Wars, Doctor Strange, Thor, Southern Bastards, and The Goddamned.
I want to wish a Merry Christmas to my people, to my family, and to my friends in circle.
Hey, welcome to another edition of iFanboy Talksplode. My name is Ron Richards, and this is our bonus episode, thanks to support of the iFanboy patrons, where we take some time out to chat with a comic creator about their work, what goes into it, what they're working on, basically what makes them tick. This time around, we're talking to one of our favorite writers, Jason Aaron, who won the Eisner Award for Best Writer earlier this year. It's been a while since I chatted with Jason in this capacity, so let's just get right to it. So I'm here with Eisner Award-winning writer Jason Aaron. How you doing, Jason?
I'm great. How are you, Ron?
Doing well. Long time no talk in this podcast format. It's been a while.
It has been a long time, right?
Yeah, it has.
Feels like it.
Yeah, but
I mean, we've talked, just not in the podcast.
Sure. Yeah. No, we talked amongst ourselves, and you know, as good friends do. But in a media position, it's been a while.
Right. So we're just talking about Disney World and tiki drinks.
Yeah, podcast, really, we're not going to talk about comics at all. We're just going to have a conversation as if we the things we talk about in our day to day basis.
Sweet.
Well, no. So I haven't officially spoken to you since the Eisners. So you were the best. You won the award for best writer. You are the best writer in comics as of this year. How does that feel?
Feels good, I guess. I don't know. Feels, you know, it was fun. It was a really fun night at the Eisners. You know, the winning that. I got up and cried a little bit and talked about my mom. And then Latour and I, you know, got to go up together for Southern Bastards. So, yeah, it was really fun. You know, I mean, it's not like I started writing comics because I wanted to win awards, or, you know, I sit home pining, wondering, you know, when am I going to win an Eisner? But, you know, it's really gratifying, and it was a big honor, a big thrill. It's fun to see Latour freak out too. You know?
Well, yeah, it is best Colonel Sanders impression.
Right. But he tackled me when we won for Southern Bastards. Literally tackled me.
Well, and that's got to be gratifying and feel good. But I mean, but the fact that to have Southern Bastards also be recognized, you know, your guy, you know, that creator and work that you guys are probably pouring more into personally than I think I've seen any creators pour into a creator-owned work. I mean, it's bleeds the South, which you guys bleed. You know, so that must have been, I can't imagine how that felt to see that get the recognition, not only because you guys did such great work on it, but because the South never really gets any respect.
Sure. I mean, you know, it was fun just because, and gratifying because, you know, we were doing a book that we didn't have any idea if, you know, anybody would be into it. I mean, nobody was clamoring for a comic book about football. So we never had any idea what to expect. I mean, it was a book that we wanted to do, that we wanted to read, that we wanted to see. And, you know, I mean, I liked there was something different. You know, there wasn't another book at Image or I think anywhere else you could point to and say it's exactly like that. So I think we liked all those things, never had any idea what people would think about it, if anybody would be into it. So yeah, it's gratifying and rewarding when you can do that book and have it be successful and have people respond to it, because it is very personal for both of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting, at least for the, you know, folk. We could talk about Latour. We could do a whole podcast about Latour, but let's talk about you.
Let's not talk about Latour at all.
I know, yeah. But to have the range between working on one of the biggest licensed books in the universe in Star Wars, right? Which is right. Essentially, you know, media property that you have no ownership of and all this stuff, but doing a great job of, but then doing a book that is so deeply rooted in what you know, when it, you know, in terms of the culture and football and all that, that kind of stuff, to see that's the one that gets celebrated. I think that's got to, you know, I imagine you throw yourself into everything you work on, but that one's got to feel a little more special, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I do. I mean, maybe it sounds like a cliche, but I think you always have to bring something of yourself to whatever you're doing. Or I do, you know, to be able to get up and do it every day. So whether I'm writing Thor or Star Wars or Strange or, you know, when I was doing X-Men or whatever, like, you got to have some kind of personal connection to it or way into it. I think to be able to do it and certainly be able to do it and have anybody like it and respond to it. So, yeah, I mean, you know, people might ask me what's my favorite book or what do I enjoy the most. I mean, it's a little like choosing between your kids, and that they all, you know, they all feel like my kids. You know, certainly things are different. And like you said, you know, Latour and I own Southern Bastards, you know, in a way that I don't own Star Wars or anything I do at Marvel. So, yeah, I mean, you certainly have more ownership over it. Which, you know, there's good and bad things that come with that, right? Like the good thing about doing a book at Image, doing a book like Southern Bastards, is that, you know, you make all the decisions. Nobody else is going to make decisions about your book except for you. That also means that you have to make all the decisions. Like, nobody else is going to come along and make them for you. So it's, you know, I love doing that, but I'm happy to be in a position where I don't have to choose between doing Star Wars and doing Southern Bastards. I get to do both, which is keeps me sane, keeps me loving my job, keeps me excited week to week about what I'm doing. I don't think I could do the Southern Bastards, you know, 52 weeks, you know, without killing myself. So I like being able to mix it up.
Yeah, I can only imagine the world where you're doing Southern Bastards 52 weeks a year and what that would do to a man.
Right. I mean, I do love football. I literally do think about football for 52 weeks a year.
Yep.
But I don't know that I want to write about it.
Yep.
The whole year. I want to write some Han Solo every once in a while.
Well, of course, yeah. So you guys are doing a benefit variant cover. Can you tell me about how that all broke down?
Yeah, well, we were already doing for this arc that just started. It's called Gut Check. You know, the things are kind of changing in the book story wise. Like, this is just with the previous issue, the end of the previous arc, we kind of just got to the point where Roberta Tubb, you know, showed up in Craw County. Like, we've kind of been building towards that moment since, you know, the first arc. So now she's here, and with this new arc, we're kind of getting to see what that means. So given that, we wanted to, with each issue of this arc, we wanted to do a variant cover focusing on her. So Becky Cloonan did the first one. and we've got others lined up. So then kind of in the midst of that, you know, the whole Chelsea Kane controversy happened, and Latour did this piece kind of just for the sake of doing it, of Roberta wearing her, you know, Ask Me About My Feminist Agenda shirt. And we decided to, you know, make that a variant cover, and give the money away to the ACLU and Southern Poverty Law Center. Cause you know, we did one of those, we did a Confederate flag variant. I forget what issue it was, a couple arcs ago, or, you know, around the time of the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. And we, you know, we raised $18,000 from the sales of that variant that we gave to,
that's amazing. That's great.
Mother Emmanuel Hope Fund. So that was really cool. So, it seemed, you know, seemed like a statement we wanted to make, and you know, another good way to raise some money for worthwhile causes.
Yeah, no, I mean, raising that amount of money with a variant is just awesome, and hopefully you guys can raise even more with this one, because especially the world we live in now, I think the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU is more important than ever. Not to get too political, but yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, we went back and forth kind of on who we would want to give that money to, and kind of and settled on splitting it between the the two of those. Yeah,
that's great. So you know, in terms of the Southern Bastards work, you know, you and Latour work, you know, super, super closely. Latour's, you know, he's doing some writing as well over at Marvel, as well as doing the art on Bastards. How has the process for you guys evolved from when you started this, you know, started the book off to the point of where you're at now, where, you know, it's at issue 16, you know, how much of the, you know, are you guys still sticking pretty standard where you're writing the script and he's drawing it? But I assume you guys are merging in the middle there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always been that way. I mean, he and I talk a lot. So we talk about what's coming up. Latour is good about what he always wants to know kind of what's coming down the road. So he's good about making me figure out, you know, maybe a little sooner than I would otherwise what's coming down the road. And he's always coming up with ideas. So we, you know, a lot of the book comes out of us talking stuff over on the phone or hanging out together and talking, because, you know, we were already friends before we started doing the book. I mean, that's kind of why the book exists in the first place, is it was really more about, you know, I was talking to you and decided I wanted to do a book in Image, and then realized, like, well, I think I want to do it with Latour, and then he and I had to figure out, all right, well, what the hell is that going to be? Right. So it was really more about the relationships than it was, you know, hey, I've got this idea in my pocket, and I'll let me find somebody to draw it. So that relationship was always the most important part of it. And it stayed like that. It's very much our thing. You know, you can't kind of pull out the parts that are me and the parts that are him. It's all kind of mixed together, you know, to a point where he's, you know, he's written an issue. He's got another issue that he's writing coming up in this arc, which was my idea, which I encouraged him to do. And you know, just kind of shows how it's very much ours. So it's a different sort of working relationship than I have on certainly on anything I do with, you know, at Marvel, and even some of the other creator-owned stuff I've done. It's very fulfilling. It's very much, I don't know how to put it. Like, it's a, I mean, he and I kind of are married, or, you know, we've started a small business together. Basically, we've gone into business together, you know, when you do a creator owned book like this. So it does feel like we're parents raising this kid together.
So if Latour is, you know, written a couple issues, when are we going to see your art debut?
I said I should do a variant cover, but I don't think would raise
a lot
of money.
No, Jason, I don't want a variant cover. I want 22 pages of sequential art done in the Jason Aaron style.
Ron, you got to let me start slow. You want me to start slow? I don't think my variant would raise a lot of money for charity, though, if we did that.
I bet you'd be surprised. I bet you.
No, I cannot draw at all. I'm terrible. I drew when I was a kid. I like to draw. And at some point in elementary school, I switched and became more interested in writing, like maybe around fourth or fifth grade. So for a while, I could still draw like a pretty good fourth grader. Like my artistic evolution stopped at that period. Now I think it's gotten worse. I think there are lots of fourth graders who can draw better than I can. So I'm terrible. I can't draw at all. And I always get so bent out of shape. You know, sometimes when you're doing signings or cons or something, there's some crazy people out there who have sketchbooks full of sketches by writers for some reason. Who'll be quite insistent that you do a sketch. So there are a few terrible sketches of mine circulating out there somewhere that hopefully, you know, never see the light of day.
I think I've seen a couple here and there, but I believe in you, Jason. I think if you practice, if you assert yourself and focus on it, I bet you could do. You'd surprise even yourself.
See, you laugh, but I've actually thought before. Like, should I take an art class? Should I go to like night school and take an art class so I could learn to draw one thing? You know, I don't know what my one thing would be. If I could learn to draw a tiger or an elephant. Just do an elephant and Roll Tide. If I could do that, if I could just get my one thing, then I could do my one sketch.
That's a good idea. So
twice a year when somebody asked me to do some shitty sketch, I could give them a more quality shitty sketch than I could previously.
Well, yeah, and then if you do two sketches, that turns into four sketches, and then next thing you know, you have an idea about a situation for that elephant, and now you're doing a little six-page backup.
Then I've got a sketchbook. Yep. I'm selling sketchbooks at cons.
Listen, Jason, I know you're talented. Don't sell yourself short. I think you could do. I want to see Jason Aaron's elephant comic.
But who's got time for all that shit? I mean, I barely know what I'm doing with the writing part of it. I don't need to be trying to tackle anything else.
So going back to the writing aspect and how you guys work. So, I mean, with you guys working so closely, are you delivering, like, what? How does your process with Latour differ from the stuff you do for Marvel? Are you delivering him a full script? Or are you guys doing it more, you know, I hate to say Marvel style, but more, you know, kind of fast and loose? Or what is the, you know?
No, I mean, it's always full script. Yeah. I mean, he and I were actually talking today. He told me he'd like to see some scripts that I'd written for artists who aren't him to kind of see the
He's getting the jealous, isn't he?
Well, I think just to compare, because I told him I think my scripts for him are looser and that I don't always, you know, I know when I don't have to explain something. I know what he's going to get. So it comes from working together so much and, you know, and being friends and hanging out. I mean, he slept at my house before. I've had dinner at his parents' house. So, it's a different sort of relationship, you know, and with Gera, who I worked with on Scalped and the Goddamn, it's the same thing. Like I kind of know we're close enough. We have similar enough sensibilities that I know if I give them these three words, they know exactly what I'm talking about and they're going to run with it.
I like the idea of you frantically editing a Dr. Strange script to have less detail to give to Jason to be like, oh yeah, no, you get the same as the other guys.
Well, Dr. Strange is a weird one. And that is kind of the one book I've done a lot of more Marvel style stuff on. A lot of the stuff I've done with Chris Pachalo has been like that.
Yeah.
He wants the freedom to kind of lay stuff out himself. So it's, I mean, again, it's one of those things that keeps my job interesting is that, especially when you have artists that you work with a lot, like, I've worked with Latour a lot. I've worked with Gera, Bachalo, Ron Garney, I've worked with a lot. So, you know, it's fun to see how that relationship progresses and, to see how your scripts can change and evolve because of that.
So, with the experience of Southern Bastards under your belt and working with Latour, and you mentioned Gera on the Goddamn, your other creator on book, because you really picked some interesting topics for your creator on books. You know?
Oh, I thought you were going to say I picked some crazy artists.
No, you picked some great artists. But like, I mean, when you back when I was at Image and we were talking about stuff, and you told me you were going to do the Goddamn with Gera, and it was going to be, you know, a biblical tale. I was like, oh, I wouldn't have predicted that. I mean, so how has, you know, something that's so drastically different in tone than Southern Bastards or any of your, you know, kind of stuff at Marvel, how has the reception to the Goddamn been now that you're on like issue six or seven now, right? Or
yeah, we just finished the first arc. We're right. Starting to work on the next
one. Yeah, five just came out, right? So six is next. Yeah.
Yep. And the six will actually be something completely different, like a completely different story than
it's gonna be like science fiction,
completely different characters and
like rocket ship.
But no, I mean, still not that different. But I mean, certainly this is a book where we can do any, you know, any fucking thing we want. Like, we're not, we can get pretty crazy in this book. But yeah, it's more like Brubaker's Criminal, where everything's set in the same world, but we'll bounce around to see a different group of characters.
Right.
But yeah, sorry. What was your question?
Well, no, I guess just kind of now that you've got one arc done of it, you know, like, and it's kind of you tackling the Bible. Are you, you know, kind of looking back on it, are you where you want to be with it? Did it come out as you had envisioned, or did it surprise you to see Gera come back with the kind of the depictions of the brutality that you laid out?
Right. I mean, I think Gera's work on it was incredible. You know, he poured a whole lot into it. I mean, that's why, you know, it took longer to come out, especially issue 5, you know, took quite a while, but, you know, at a certain point, I realized we're not going to rush him. Like, we're going to let him. I mean, you can see the work he's pouring into it, and we kind of just wanted to let him do that.
Right.
Yeah, I think it looks incredible. You know, I think it takes everything up a notch that he was doing on Scalped. So I was super happy with it. I mean, I knew going into it, this is not a book for everybody. You know, I mean, it's called The Goddamned. It's, you know, the opening chunk of the first issue, our main character is naked and, you know, murdering a huge group of people. We call God the C word at one point, like right out of the gate. We wanted to let you know, like, this is what you bought into, motherfuckers. Like, this is, you know, if you keep going from this point, it's on you. You know, we told you what you're in for. So we knew it wouldn't be the book for everybody. So I didn't have any idea what the response would be to it. You know, it's ugly too. Like, it's meant to be ugly. I told Gera, you know, coming into it, like every single person we meet in this book, except for Cain, should be deformed or diseased or scarred or disfigured, you know, in some way. Even children, even babies, like nobody looks perfect. Everybody's fucked up in this world, like, except for the one guy, you know, who can't die. So yeah, it can. I can see how you could look at it and say that book's a little too grim for me. That book's a little too dark. But I mean, it's something that I've wanted to do for years. I mean, since I pitched this book when I first pitched Scalped back in the day, so it's been bouncing around for a long time. And yeah, I liked that it was something different. Again, you know, there's no other gritty, violent Bible comic out there right now. Like, we
really
have the market cornered on that shit.
You're all by yourselves on that shelf in that section.
Absolutely. So I like that. I mean, again, I like, you know, I like the adding to the diversity of genres and stories and comics and doing shit that's different than other people are doing. And it doesn't have to be your thing. I mean, you know, clearly I enjoy it. And it's therapeutic for me, you know, to write about the Bible as somebody who's raised in the South and raised in the church. And I have a lot of strong feelings about that and about religion in general. So, you know, and also I'm just kind of in love with the stories of the Bible. So this is me pouring all that into a comic. And, you know, we're just getting started on this. Like I said, this is really about exploring that world. So each arc will be exploring a different corner of that world. And what we're doing for the next arc, it's called The Virgin Brides. It's going to be completely different than the opening arc.
Yeah, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, was kind of what the long-term plan was. I mean, you know, if you're gonna bounce around in that world, are you basically looking to the Bible to say, like, okay, these are the stories I want to tell, or I want to do my version of, or are there, you know?
Yeah, some of that. You know, I mean, this first arc was really a really fucked up version of the story of Noah's Ark, right?
Yeah.
So this next one is kind of the origin of the Nephilim, who are the giants. You know, we saw one of the giants in this first arc. It's kind of the story of where those guys come from. That comes from a couple of verses in the book of Genesis. So yeah, a lot of it will be stories of the Bible we're doing in very different kind of ways. I mean, in terms of the overall story, you know, you look at the first arc, it's called Before the Flood. And, yeah, you know, that issue 5 ends with it starting to rain. So that tells you where we're going. You know, this is a book about the world on the eve of its first apocalypse. So this is this world is so completely out of control that God's about to, you know, send a flood and wipe it clean, basically. So we're just going to bounce around and explore other parts of that world as we move closer to, you know, that coming flood.
Well, yeah, I gotta say, I mean, I went to at least kindergarten through eighth grade of religious school classes after school, and it was never as interesting as the goddamn has been. So I think I should probably look at the curriculum, and it'd be a lot more interesting if it was that.
Well, you know, I mean, the Bible is filled with murder and sex. Yeah. We're just kind of putting it all out there.
Yeah. I guess the us Roman Catholics don't really like to share the fun parts. That's the...
sure.
Well, cool. Well, so you'd mentioned, you know, kind of part of the motivation of doing the goddamn was to put something out there that's not, you know, hasn't been done or hasn't been out there before. You know, looking over to your work at Marvel, you know, we're about a year into Doctor Strange. And Doctor Strange has always been that title, that character that a lot of creators say if they could work on one character, it would be Doctor Strange. And yet nobody's really been able to make it work. You know, I feel like Brian K. Vaughan was the Oath was the last one that was everyone points to as like the good Doctor Strange until you came along, of course. So what was your, you know, when you got offered Doctor Strange or when you asked for Doctor Strange, what was kind of the initial pitch and how does that compare to where we are now a year later?
I asked for it.
Yeah.
I think I was, I don't remember why. I mean,
you're like, I hear there's a movie. Can I get in on that?
Well, that all kind of happened around the same time. you know, the Doctor Strange and Thor, two of the characters I've done the most of the last few years, neither one of those were characters I grew up loving. Yeah. Like I read the Simonson stuff on Thor as a kid and loved that, but I didn't have a whole bunch of Thor comics, and Doctor Strange was the same way. I'd read a little bit of it, but never really loved it. So they were never characters I was, you know, I wasn't carrying around a briefcase all my time in comics full of Doctor Strange and Thor ideas.
Well, hold on, wait, you have a briefcase? let's back up. Is it?
What kind? I used to have a briefcase. Surely I've still got my briefcase here somewhere. It's just full of Fantastic Four pitches.
those are worthless these days.
but my point was that, you know, those were I wasn't clamoring my whole life or career to write Thor or Doctor Strange. They both just kind of seemed to be the right character at the right time. So. I think I was reading that Untold Story of Marvel Comics book, you know, which talks a lot about the Marvel of the 70s. So, you know, Engelhardt and Steve Gerber and all those guys. And, you know, I love that stuff as a fan. You know, I was always a big fan of Engelhardt, so got to hang out with him at a show in Spain one time. He was a great guy. So I think reading that, and kind of thinking about, you know, what did I want to do next? Doctor Strange just kind of sparked. It's like, yeah, I'd like to take a shot at that. And it was literally like a week later that Kevin Feige mentioned Doctor Strange for the first time, like in an interview or something. So I was like, well, shit, we're going to be doing a Doctor Strange book soon. So I, you know, threw my name in the hat. And that, you know, still took a couple of years, I think, before that actually happened. So by the time The same way with Thor. Like, I just kind of said, I want to do Thor, and then had to figure out, all right, shit, now what do I do with Thor? So Strange was the same way. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. I mean, we talked a lot about whenever we have retreats, we would, over the years, we would talk every once in a while, talk about magic. You know, it's like, how do we figure out magic in the Marvel Universe? And how do we fix this? You know, we'd talk about cosmic the same way times. And, you know, with eventually it was with magic, I was like, we don't have to figure out anything. We don't have to fix anything. You know, we don't have to write a long list of, like, here are the 50 rules of magic if you're going to write about it in the Marvel Universe. I mean, for me, I just wanted one rule, and that's that, you know, Strange can't be the deus ex machina, and he can't just wave his fingers and save the day without any consequence or repercussions. Like, that this guy has more consequences and repercussions to everything he does, you know, more than anybody else in the Marvel Universe. You know, I mean, Cap throws a shield and it bounces back. No big deal. But when Doctor Strange does something, it's got, you know, unbelievable effects, you know, all throughout our dimension. So I like that idea that, you know, this guy is paying the hugest price for what he does. He has to balance the price he's paying personally and what's being paid by, you know, kind of the universe at large. So that kind of formed the basis of what I wanted to do. And you know, we wanted to set up that Strange hasn't been doing a good job of paying this price, and kind of the bill comes due. We introduce a new enemy who, you know, manages to almost wipe out magic. So then we kind of take Strange's legs out from under him and make him a guy who's not just waving his fingers and shooting, you know, magic moonbeams at everybody. He's got to jump in there and mix it up a little bit more and really work a lot harder for everything that he gets.
So how much of a mandate with books like Doctor Strange and Thor, like, does the axe come in after you establish the story, or are you going into it, how can I get an axe in this guy's hands? Because I see a theme of axes.
I don't remember. I don't think was the axe my idea with Strange, or was it Chris? I don't remember why, but we wanted him, again, to be more hands-on with stuff. So we wanted to see him use weapons or different tools. So I think when some of Chris's sketches that he did, he had an axe and he had a bow and arrow, and some, you know, we saw him use a bow and arrow in one issue. So I don't think I explicitly asked for an axe. I think that came from Chris. A lot of the stuff came from Chris. Right. You know, life that Chris brought to the Cape, you know, that was all him. You know, he was kind of doing that, you know, before the movie did it, really. Like, Chris was, you see a lot of that, the Cape, its cloak is very much alive, like a living thing, which we don't even always talk about or address. It's just happening there in the panels.
And that was one thing I wanted to ask about working with Bocello, because Bocello has, you know, has got the reputation of being, you know, one of the more out there artists and doing all stuff like that. Is he just drawing that because he finds it interesting, or once he did that, did you then start working in, okay, have the Cape doing this in the background, or what's the give or take between all that just insanity on every page? I mean, there's so much on every page that he draws.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, you know, he and I had worked together a little bit on Wolverine the X-Men. And we got into a point doing that where I'd work in a more Marvel style, because, you know, Chris was kind of going to break it down the way he wanted to break it down. So I think it was maybe the first issue of Wolverine the X-Men. I think I wrote one splash page and he drew three. and then you would get those, you know, crazy Chris Bocciallo pages with, you know, like 30 panels on them, you know, that I would never have the guts to write for him, but that he would write for himself.
Yeah.
So once, you know, me and Nick Lowe, my editor, realized, like, why should I break this down into panels? We'll let him do that. You know, he's awesome at it. So I just started writing it's not a straight Marvel style, but I'll just say, you know, like, pages 1 through 4, all this stuff happens and all the dialogue's in there too, but I don't break anything down into panels. So we carried that over into Strange for the most part. Sometimes deadlines get in the way and I might have to do a partial script, and then I'll do it in more straightforward full script. But So yeah, with Chris, there's always a lot of leeway in that he puts a lot into it. I mean, he wasn't sold on Doctor Strange initially. I kind of had to talk him into it a little bit, but once he got into it, he's been very invested and has a lot of ideas.
So in that situation, how do you talk him into Doctor Strange? I mean, like, if you know, there's an artist that
begging and pleading and
just annoying until he relents, or
well, you know, I think it's just, yeah. I mean, he is literally the first guy I ever mentioned for the book. You know, Doctor Strange is one of those where it's so much of it is about the art, right? Like, you can't just throw anybody on that book and have it work. Some characters are like that. I think Hulk is like that, Ghost Rider. Some of them are so much about the visuals, and Doctor Strange, I think, was in that category. It's got to be somebody who's got a little bit of Ditko in them, right? Who can pull off the super weird, crazy stuff and can transport you to all these different places we need to transport you. So as soon as I was, you know, it seemed like the book was going to be mine, I was like, it's got to be Chris. And everybody was sold on that except Chris, so we had to convince him. And I think it just came from talking to him about, you know, this is what I want to do, and it's a bit different kind of take on Doctor Strange. And he was really down with that, and again, has thrown out a lot of ideas. You know, the issue that just came out, I think our most recent issue, I forget which number it is. It's the weirdest issue we've done. It takes place in a diner in hell, and you know, Strange eats some demonic bacon and has to.
Is that the white and red cover? Issue 14, right?
Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah.
That was Chris's idea. Chris had some ideas just when we were talking about the cover, and I wasn't even sure. I knew the issue was going to be Doctor Strange and Satana, but I didn't know exactly much beyond that. So Chris had all these crazy ideas about Hell's Diner, and so everything kind of grew out of that. So yeah, he's had a lot of ideas, and the you know, it's redesigned the look of Strange a couple times. We've gotten a couple different looks in the book, so it's been a big thrill. I mean, I loved working with him on Wolverine the X-Men. That's still some of my favorite stuff I've done, so it's great to be able to work with him on something like this that was, you know, I think even wackier and crazier than what we've done in the X-Men.
Right. And so, I love Bocello, and he's great, but there have been a couple of covers by Kevin Nolan, right?
Yeah, and some interiors, too.
Yeah, and some interiors as well. And when I think of two artists with, you know, kind of opposite styles, I don't think they get a little more wider than Nolan and Bocello.
Sure. Yeah. But I think they still work on the same book in my mind. I think they're guys who are both such master draftsmen and both, you know, idiosyncratic guys who don't look like anybody else, right? Like, right. You see a cover or a page by either one of those dudes and you know right away who it is. And yeah, Kevin's the nicest guy. He, you know, he lives not too far away from me, here in Kansas. So I've gotten to hang out with him at a show.
Really? For some reason, I've always had in my head that he's British.
No.
Right? Like, did I make that up? I must have made that up.
You totally
something.
Made that up. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, it was a huge thrill to work with him. Yeah, he'd done, worked on a couple of different issues and done quite a few covers for us, I think.
Yeah, it's been great stuff. Cool. So, moving on to Thorland. I didn't realize until I was prepping for this interview. You've been on Thor for over 4 years now. And it feels like just yesterday it just started with Gore, the God Killer, and all stuff like that. And what made me think of it was after reading the most recent issue of Unworthy Thor, where it seems to be circling back to that first story that you told. Is your run on Thor just one big long, you know, long story that you planned out from the beginning, or have you just been lucky enough to have it go this way? But if it is one big long thing, does Lady Thor work in that, or is that something that just happened along the way? Like, how have you plotted out your Thor adventure from 4 years ago today?
Well, yes and no to all that. Yes, it is been one long story and will continue to be one long story, and everything is connected. No, I haven't always known every piece of it. Some stuff, you know, has come up along the way, or some stuff has changed. But yeah, I mean, when I got that job, it was me asking kind of out of the blue. I realized, like, I think I'd really like to do Thor.
I love the idea of you at the retreats just shouting out characters. Like, I want to do Thor. All right, what's your idea? I don't have one.
That's not very far fetched. That was kind of pretty much it. I did not have an idea. I had I remember telling Axel I wanted to do it, and he said, like, all right, Esad's going to draw it. And I was like, shit, I got to figure out a story. So, you know, the God Butcher story was a big story. That was like 11 issues, I think.
Yep.
But it was always, you know, the beginning of something bigger. So I had a lot of plans, a lot of big Thor plans right out of the gate. And I always knew I was building towards a moment where he found himself unworthy and couldn't pick up the hammer. And I knew, you know, that I wanted to do a story where somebody else picked it up. The idea for who that was, initially it was going to be Thor's mom, Freya, was going to pick it up and wield it for a bit. But then kind of the opportunity was there to do a big relaunch of the book and have it be a bigger thing. And it became Jane Foster was like the only other option. That was a story that kind of seemed like I had planned it the whole time when I really hadn't. I mean, I was already kind of setting up to tell a specific story with a Jane, and it kind of fit together perfectly with this new story. So I've been having a tremendous amount of fun with that. And again, everything with her story and everything that's still going on with the Odin son, it all kind of ties in with the same theme that goes back to that God Butcher story. I mean, that the idea of, you know, the gods are really terrible, and do we need them? And, you know, is Thor a good god? And what does that even mean to be a good god? And what does it mean to be worthy? Those are the questions that will run through my entire run on the book. We might seem to drift away from it a little bit, but we always come back to it in a big way. And I think the arc that's about, you're seeing that in a big way in the Unworthy Thor miniseries, and you're about to see it in the Asgard Shi'ar War that's beginning in Mighty Thor. Those questions always keep coming back. And yeah, now we see, you know, even Gore popping back up in Unworthy number 2.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, that was what kind of grabbed me as reading Unworthy, because at first, I had to take a moment to get used to the Olivier Coppel art, because that he's just like, he's so good. So you're very lucky to get him on board as well, too.
Oh, absolutely.
but it was the revisiting of Gore and revisiting of what the Whisper was, and then that kind of, I mean, honestly, I mean, like, got me. Not that I mean, I've been reading Mighty Thor. You know, Dowderman's been great. I love what you guys have been doing with that. But this kind of, you know, kind of it re-energized me in terms of like, oh, this is just one big long thing, as opposed to a bunch of like, this happened and now we've got Lady Thor and now this is happening. So I was impressed, Jason. So good job. Good job to make it look like you planned it.
It's all about me trying to impress your own.
I know, that's what it comes down to. So,
yeah, I mean, I think I've been incredibly lucky and fortunate with the artists I've had on my Thor run, you know, going back to Esad, and then, you know, Russell Dowderman, like you said, has been the main guy on the Jane Foster Thor stuff. And I think, I mean, I say every arc that this is the best stuff Russell's ever done. And I actually mean it, because he somehow continues to just get better and better and more impressive with every story. And I think this stuff he's doing in the Asgard Shi'ar war storyline just looks incredible. He and Matt Wilson are, you know, I think one of the best art teams in comics. Yeah. So the fact that I could get them at the same time I'm getting Olivier is just, you know, I'm almost embarrassed by that, by those riches.
Well, I mean, you are the best writer in comics as of today. So, I mean, it just seems as if...
That's what the statue behind my desk says. So it must be true.
Yeah. Well, so talking about great art, moving where we can wrap up here on Star Wars, which is currently my favorite book at Marvel, my 2016 pick of the year.
Sure, it was even despite your major gripe about it.
Oh well, we're gonna get to that, Jason. So you just hold on. We're gonna get to that.
I didn't mean to jump the gun.
We're gonna get to that. But you know, I felt as if we were totally spoiled. Oh geez, it must have been about a year ago now or whatever. But when Immonen was doing his work with you on Star Wars, because Immonen is just a monster and it's just so good.
Sure.
But you know, with this, the last arc of Star Wars that wrapped up at issue 25, which I don't know if you still listen to the podcast or not, but I did proclaim it was the best arc of the series, I thought. But I was
thank you.
I was really impressed with Jorge Molina. And I wanted to know how closely you worked with Molina to, like, it really seems as if he stepped up with this arc.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we've worked, you know, I've worked any more closely with him than anything else on Star Wars or at Marvel. You know, it's, at Marvel, it's, you know, usually I write the script and turn it in, and whoever draws it, I probably don't even know who's going to draw it, you know, when I'm writing that first one. But you know, whatever I'm doing for Marvel, I'm trying to leave it open, loose enough that, whoever that artist is, they can bring, you know, a lot of themselves to it. I don't write super detailed, panel descriptions and that sort of thing. So,
well, that's one thing I wanted to ask was, so how does the process differ with Star Wars given Lucasfilm and all that sort of stuff? Like, you know, do you have a opportunity to say, you know, this is a short list of artists I want, or are you just completely turning in scripts and then walking away and hoping for the best?
No, I mean, I'm always involved. It's certainly a different process. It's a much, you know, longer process. So, cause everything's got to run through Lucasfilm. So we have to do stuff, you know, way more in advance. Cause they approve every part of it. So yeah, it's a very different sort of process. But it's been a lot of fun. Like I don't think I really knew how much fun it was going to be. I mean, I'm a Star Wars fan. I've always been a Star Wars fan going back to being a kid. I don't know that I'm a giant Star Wars. I was ever a huge Star Wars fan. I think doing this has made me even more of a Star Wars fan. Not necessarily more of a Wedge Antilles fan, but
again,
definitely
we're gonna go there, Jason. So I'm indulging you to start to keep digging your own hole. But yeah.
You just want to flatter me up until the very end. And
yeah, pretty much.
Well, ribs.
I mean, what I want to understand is that how you proclaim, you know, you aren't the biggest Star Wars. So tell me about your Star Wars fandom. Tell me about your history with Star Wars. Right? Like, did you see it in the theater? Like, where did Star Wars enter your life?
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing Empire in the theater. I can't remember when I saw A New Hope. Yeah. You know, I had shitloads of Star Wars action figures and toys and loved the movies. I mean, I think I was, I mean, I, as a kid and even now, like I like a lot of different kinds of stuff. I was never like just a comic guy or just a, you know, a fantasy guy or a sci-fi guy. I kind of liked a little bit of everything. I like sports. I like wrestling. I like Godzilla movies. And, you know, I'm a Renaissance man when it comes to things of a nerd and geek nature. Like, I like a little bit of all of it. So Star Wars is just kind of one part of that. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I never read much of the expanded universe stuff or the comics. I read small amount of the Dark Horse comics, I guess, growing up.
So, all right. So you're a well rounded individual and child growing up, but I want to know. I want to know what's.
I don't know if I'd say that, but
we'll leave it at rounded. So, what was 7 year old Jason Aaron's toy chest like? Did you have the action figures? Were you in as deep as all of us were, or did you?
Oh,
just,
yeah. You mean just Star Wars?
Yeah,
just
Star Wars. We're focusing on Star Wars.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've still got my Darth Vader action figure case in the basement.
Yeah,
I've still got my Ewok village. Yeah, I mean, I've still got all my G.I. Joes and my He-Man and everything. I was a big toy guy. Like I have brothers and a sister, but they're all a good bit older than me. The youngest ones are like 7 years older than me. So, you know, I kind of was more like an only child. And I grew up in the middle of nowhere in a small town. So, there was no like riding my bicycle to see my friends. They were all pretty far away. So I spent a lot of time playing by myself. I played in the woods a lot. Like I had like a little kind of a lean-to I built in the woods. So it was a lot of me like making up stories and playing with toys. That was my childhood. So I spent a lot of time, you know, inside my own head. So,
all right. Well, so we didn't have that dissimilar of upbringings. I mean, and I don't know if it's my Northeast liberal upbringing compared to your Southern. Uh-huh. I'm just trying to discern where the shift or where things went wrong, where you don't acknowledge or even subscribe to the fact that Mr. Wedge Antilles is the hero of the rebellion, because we saw the same movie. We played with the same toys.
Yes, we did.
It's just, to me, it's math. It's like 2 + 2 = 4. Hero plus rebellion equals Wedge. So
I think the question is, where did you go wrong? What happened in your childhood to make you go down this strange little side path? With such a fervency.
Well, I just don't understand how you can question Wedge's role in the rebellion of anything other than heroism.
How about the evidence? The evidence doesn't make you. The evidence you see with your eyes on the silver screen.
Listen, he was no good back there. There's no sense of getting killed over nothing.
He's definitely no good back there.
He's going to live to fight another battle, another day. I support him pulling out in Star Wars made perfect sense.
Right. So I will agree with everything you said. It's just the part where he becomes the hero of the revolution. But look, you have badgered me about Reg Antilles since I took over the book. You and Josh both.
Well, so, I think badger is an extreme verb to use.
I think I'm being kind. So I, being the good guy that I am and the true friend, one of your best friends.
Indeed.
I finally relented and gave you what you asked for. I gave you a Wedge Antilles appearance in the Star Wars comic book, which is canon, by the way.
Yep.
I gave you an appearance. I knew you'd be so happy. I even texted you that day and sent you a screenshot of my script with the words Wedge Antilles in it.
Yeah, but it was the other words that Wedge was saying.
And I guess it's a good life lesson for you that, you know, sometimes with the joy, you're going to get a bit of sorrow.
It was a bitter pill to swallow to finally see Wedge grace the pages of the Star Wars comic, only to realize that very quickly that, oh God, don't be careful what you wish for. Speaking of that, I mean, you've heard us talk about the I've got this phenomenon, right?
Sure, I've heard too much of you talk about it at this point.
So as a writer...
On the podcast and over drinks.
As a writer, where do you weigh in on the I've got this controversy? Do you agree with us that it is an overused trope, or do you think that it just reflects the language of today? And after hearing us, do you now hesitate before you put it into scripts?
Well, I will certainly think of you next time it pops up. I mean, I suppose it's an overly used. I don't know that I'd go so far to call it a trope. I mean, it's an overused phrase, sure. It didn't bother me in that context in which I used it. Maybe I'll think twice before I ever use it again.
Right.
It doesn't stick in my craw the way that it does yours. It's not. It's not one of the things on my list, you know.
Well, I don't know how many comics do you read on a weekly basis? Like, do you have a pull list, or how are you as a reader?
Oh, I read a shitload. Yeah, I read a lot. I have a big pull list.
Yeah, because it was Connor who pointed it out a couple of years ago, where it's like literally you can't go a week without seeing it in a comic. And then I shared that with my comic store proprietor in San Francisco, and he got all mad at me about a month later. He's like, God damn it, you've ruined my reading comics now.
Are you talking about James?
Yeah, exactly. So it's all out of nowhere. It seems as if it grew to a disproportionate frequency, and it just seemed as if there are better ways to get that across.
See, but when you say that, it just makes me want to use it more. Just to piss you off.
Here's a question. When you do publish your elephant comic that you write and draw, can you call it "I've Got This"?
I've got this.
An elephant.
Colon, Roll Tide.
An elephant story. Roll Tide. Anyway, so back to Star Wars. So, in terms of, you know, so like you're living in this interesting space of in between the first movie and the second movie, right? And as you said, that these stories are canon. So how much of the give and take is it between your story ideas and where Lucasfilm wants to see the characters go? Like, you know, have they said, listen, we really want to see a badass Stormtrooper Legion, or is there something, or is it purely just you giving them and them approving and moving on? I know this is behind the scenes, but this is the kind of shit that everybody's curious about. So,
Yeah, I mean, they haven't really given us a lot of direction that we want you to do this or we want you to do that. It's more,
you can't do this.
Right. Us saying like, hey, we want to do these 25 things. And they'd say, well, you can do 4.5 of them, you know, like that kind of. No, I don't think they've ever given us a directive of do this or do that. Of course, I haven't gotten to do everything I wanted to do, but, you know, that's the same thing as when I'm working at Marvel. I've been really excited and pleased with the stuff we have gotten to do, especially coming right out of the gate, you know, in that first arc. I felt like we were able to sell it as a big book, you know, that we could put Luke and Vader face to face, and we had Luke figure out a way to have Luke fight Boba Fett, and we had Boba Fett be the one to say the name Skywalker to Vader for the first time. So those all felt like big, you know, meaty, important moments. Putting Vader and Jabba the Hutt face to face. So I liked all that big stuff we've been able to do. You know, I think it's harder to do that every arc. It's hard to kind of find the space to do stories that seem big and meaningful when, you know, we all know where these characters are going to end up, and where we're going. And I never wanted to be a book that was just filled with, all new characters. You know, I want to see Luke and Han and Leia and Chewie and everybody we know and love, at the heart of it, the forefront of it. So it was just trying to figure out how to do stories with them that feel big and fresh and interesting. So yeah, I really liked that. I had a lot of fun with the stolen Star Destroyer story. Yeah. You know, again, we want to do something that just felt like Star Wars. It felt like it's another chapter of that story we all love. Part of that, I guess, was introducing this new group of Stormtroopers, and that just came from me wanting some other bad guys, because there's only so much we can do with Vader when he pops up. And I wanted to do, you know, kind of a sort of a G.I. Joe version of a group of Stormtroopers, have like a, you know, small group of you know, the demolition guy and the sharpshooter and the guy. I just realized it now,
but that's the most accurate way to describe them. They're
right. And to have them be, you know, badass, to have them actually kill people and accomplish things. You know, we'll continue to see those guys pop up and butt heads with their heroes.
Yeah. So one of the questions that came up while we were talking about on the podcast was, you know, it's 25 issues in. I think it was Josh who posed the question, which is this just completely ongoing, or is this ever going to, you know, suffer from the Marvel renumber one-ing or and or how much of this do you have in you? Like, is doing, you know, this kind of level of a book that's got so much oversight taxing to the writing that ever makes it not fun? And, you know, is that the point when you walk away? Or
I mean I can't speak to kind of, you know, what Marvel's overall plans are for everything. I mean, I know kind of where what my plans are, you know, and I've turned in, you know, outlines that go a few arcs past what's come out. We'll see. Like, next year is going to be a different sort of year for me. I mean, I haven't had to do anything at Marvel, especially these last few years, that wasn't fun.
Right.
Like, I really love everything I'm doing. You know, and the I think my only problem is maybe, especially lately, is I've got a lot. You know, doing two Thor books and Doctor Strange and Star Wars requires a little more work than the other Marvel stuff I do. And then two creator-owned books on the top of that. So I've just been busy. So I think, you know, at some point next year, you'll see me downshift a little bit and some stuff start to change around. Which, you know, it's always going to happen every few years. But
sure, yeah.
I don't know. Don't guess I should say anything beyond that, other than I'm excited to. I'm lucky. Like, I genuinely do like what I do. I'm always excited. You know, every week when I get to wake up and trudge upstairs and sit here and make up silly stories and actually make a living at it. I'm love that I've never had to choose between doing creator owned stuff like Bastards and Goddamn and stuff that's, you know, very dark and personal and stuff that I own with my co-creators. Yeah. And at the same time, getting to, you know, write Thor for 4 years and getting to relaunch Doctor Strange and getting to launch, you know, Marvel's first Star Wars book in years. Like, I love all that stuff, like, genuinely. Like, I never a guy who started working at Marvel just because I wanted a career in comics and I knew, like, well, this is the way you do it. You know, if that was why I was here to begin with, I wouldn't still be here. I'm at Marvel because I still love it.
You could tell a little bit of the truth, Jason. You're at Marvel for our shared love of the X-Men.
See, I mean, you love X-Men more than I do, too.
I love X-Men more than anybody.
You too love X-Men more than most everybody. If I was writing the characters that I was most attached to as a kid, like in my formative years, I would be doing Atari Force for DC and Longshot probably for Marvel.
I would read the hell out of your Longshot series, by the way. Oh, man, that would be great.
Probably some Batman, some Blue Devil. Yeah.
it's clear that you're, I mean, you definitely, I mean, there's a reason why you are the best writer in comics as of now, thanks to the Eisner Committee, because you're putting in that, you know, whatever that is that you do, whether it's, you know, kind of combination love or combination of just great storytelling that makes every book that, I mean, you're one of the few writers who it's still to this day where, and I'm not shining your shoes because I've shined your shoes years ago and that's how we became friends. But if you look at it, like we always say how you're able to, you know, I read all the books that you write currently, and each one is different. No book is the same. You know, a lot of people, some writers fall in the same, oh, well, he writes this type of stuff. But, you know, like going back to the, I mean, I miss Wolverine the X-Men because there was so much humor in that book, you know, and if anything, I get a little bit of the humor from the Star Wars side, but I think you've got a way funnier side to you that I don't think is currently coming out as strong in the comics as it has in the past. So.
Well, I think you'd see some of that in Doctor Strange.
Hopefully. Yeah, true. Yep. All right, so my last question for you about Star Wars, or actually two questions for you about Star Wars, is that when you go meet with Lucasfilm, do you have to pretend to like the prequels?
No.
Okay, good. And number two, where do you fall on the Return of the Jedi end song? Do you prefer the special edition New Agey song, or are you a Yub Nub man? And Jason, answer this question. Be very careful how you answer this question.
I feel like there's no right answer to this.
Oh no, there's a right answer.
I don't know. We got this. That's my answer.
Excellent. All right, Jason. Well, thank you for the time. Appreciate it. You know, we'll keep reading all the great stuff and look forward to what's coming out in 2017. And thank you for giving us stuff to talk about on the podcast this whole year. I know the iFan base has a lot of your fans are listen to the podcast, so we appreciate it on behalf of all them.
Well, thanks, sir. I love you guys.
And a big thank you to Jason Aaron for giving some time out of his busy schedule to chat with us, especially right before the holidays. And even a bigger thanks to you, the listener, and the supporting iFanboy patrons. If you want to help support iFanboy, you can go to patreon.com/iFanboy, where you can sign up there as little as $1 a month, and you get some great rewards, little perks. We'll even give you a free superpower on the podcast on a weekly basis, so you can listen for that. It's a great time. We thank everybody for supporting us at patreon.com/iFanboy. Head over to iFanboy.com, where you can find other interviews like this, as well as all the great comic book discussion on a weekly basis. It's all there at iFanboy.com. So until next time, I'm Ron, and have a great holidays. I just want to wish a Merry Christmas to my people, to my family, and to my friends in Circle Real Life on my website, and on Xbox, and at the post office, and I mean, it's a very